The Meaning of Geranium from The Secret Language of Plants by Andrina, read by Sam Gabriel, based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 11. Past Enemies Never Gone. It is so easy to think of war and evil as something that happens exclusively to young people, young and beautiful and heroic, fighting across the land. It is so easy to forget that war doesn't respect any spaces, and it certainly doesn't respect the elderly and the ugly and the sick. It was made obvious under the new regime that not everyone was equally deserving. Not everyone merited receiving an education or possessing a wand or getting medical assistance. Certainly not the Muggleborns, but neither did the Half-Bloods who would taint the facilities with their presence, and the Blood Traders. Well, they had made their choice, hadn't they? They had decided to become polluted. You couldn't just corrupt yourself and then expect to still receive the treatment befitting a true pureblood, not when you insisted on not acting like one. That is the thing about war. It affects everyone, even in the things you have taken for granted. Those things are, in fact, the first to go. Take her, for example. She had spent 14 years, 14 years, in a cold cell in which everything was hard stone and iron and unforgiving wood. She had spent 14 years dressed in a coarse tunic, without a comb for her hair or a soft ointment for her dry skin. 14 years of cracked lips and plain food, and a single smelly piss-pot in a corner. She had been affected by the war, and they had taken from her things she never expected that it would occur to them to take. Not only her jewelry, the ruby earrings she had been wearing at the time of her arrest, but smaller things like her shoes and her stockings. She had not been allowed to have socks. 14 years of bare feet and cold toes, and one single piece of underwear. And now they found themselves once again in an open war, a war that they were winning. Now she was affected differently, and she had the finest stockings around her legs. Now she lived in the warmest rooms, rooms in which there was always a fire, and she could wear nothing but the thinnest and softest fabrics. Now the merchant set aside the finest delicacies for her, the sweetest and freshest foods. Now she slept with silk sheets in her bed, and as she lay there with the husband she barely remembered how to love, Bellatrix Lestrange had a thought. Wouldn't it be neat if they were to go and finish what they started? They had waited for the return of their lord, and they had been rewarded. But it occurred to her now that just as they had waited for the Dark Lord, others had been waiting for them. "Shall we pay a visit to the Longbottoms, Rodolphus dear?" It had been said that Ernestina Pileski was the huffliest huffle to ever puff. It was a joke between her friends because she cared so damn much about everything. No wonder she had become a meta-wizard and later worked in the thankless long-term ward rather than the more interesting magical accidents. She cared about her patients and about her job, and she always tried to do her best, tirelessly, even if they saw little to no progress. She argued that if they did nothing, maybe they would see them deteriorate, so no signs of progress could be a good thing. Just because someone wasn't going to get better, it didn't mean you should stop helping. Now Ernestina was crying, and although she tried not to make a sound, it meant she couldn't speak. Her chest was heaving and her face was an ugly red, because Ernestina had yet to learn how to cry in a pretty way. Her boss, Lorna Elderberry, threw her a disgusted look as she went to welcome their visitors to the ward, Mr. and Mrs. Lestrange. Lorna, as opposed to Ernestina, didn't particularly care about her patients. She had taken the long-term ward because she saw it as an opportunity to become chief of ward at age 32, and if she managed to pull a couple of miracle recoveries, then she would have a very decent shot to make it to head manager before 10 years had passed. Not in St. Mungo, perhaps, but some other institution. Lorna was a Slytherin. She had ambition. "Pileski, take this man away from Mrs. Lestrange," Lorna said with that damned enunciation of hers, every word drawn in crystal. She was 2 steps ahead of Ernestina, but of course it was not up to her to do it. You have such lovely hair, my dear. So do I. It is, in fact, one of my most striking features, the first being my smile, of course. 5 consecutive times winner of Witch Weekly's Most Charming Smile Award. Gilderoy Lockhart demonstrated his award-winning smile on Bellatrix, who seemed undecided on whether to be amused or insulted. His hair was not as carefully coiffed as when he entered St. Mungo, but the smile was still very good. "One of our worst cases, I am afraid," Lorna explained as she stopped in front of the Lestranges, and here was a woman who knew how to walk in high heels. Lorna was also the kind of person who never got lipstick stains on her teeth, and her eyeliner looked like the one in the magazines. Ernestina never managed to get it even, and one eye always had more black than the other, but Lorna always looked ready for a photo shoot or a dinner party with the minister. "Severe memory loss together with delusions," she said. "The problem, of course, is elucidating whether the delusions were part of the original personality or not. Fascinating, yet tiresome." She smiled. Today she was wearing dark green lipstick that matched her shoes, and she looked fantastic. "To what do we owe the honor of your visit, madam?" Bella smiled. She was still a very attractive woman, so much so that most people managed not to be disturbed by the madness coming from her eyes. "Oh, I just thought I'd come see some old friends." Bella spoke as if everything were a joke to her, somewhere between a pout and a mocking tone. "Never liked leaving things unfinished."
"Well, I've been known to leave many a young witch finished yet undone," peeped Lockhart happily as he wagged his eyebrows and flashed once again his award-winning smile. He remained completely unaware of the glacial response to his words.
"Pileski," called Lorna, cold and detached.
Ernestina nodded and sniffled and hurried to take Lockhart by the elbow and gently guide him away.
"My apologies."
"No need. He's most entertaining."
Bella's eyes were fixed on Lockhart's backside as he was taken away. He blew her a kiss over his shoulder and tossed his blonde mane 3 times.
"I suppose he could be considered, sir," Lorna said, perfectly aseptic.
She smiled once more, but she didn't show her teeth this time.
"Shall we see about the patients that brought you here, madam, sir?"
She had that perfect speech. Polite without being so obsequious as to imply you were far below, but respectful enough to say that even though they were all Slytherins and pureblood here, some were better than others. Bella liked the tone, and she liked her. She had addressed her before her husband.
"Frank and Alice Longbottom, if you please. I think we will be relieving you of the burden of hosting them."
Bella spoke as if she were doing a favor to a friend, as if she had just handed Lorna a napkin or a pocket mirror.
"Ah."
Lorna raised her eyebrows ever so slightly. This was the key. This was the big part.
"Longbottom."
The name left her lips in ice and smoke.
"Terribly sorry to hear that. Pileski, do stop your blubbering and bring me the file for Longbottom F and Longbottom A. L comes after K, darling."
Ernestina took a big breath of air and dabbed quickly with her sleeve at the tears that had come to her eyes when she heard the name. She nodded and went to retrieve the files, and in the meantime, Gilderoy Lockhart wandered back to the room and started to lean seductively against the wall.
"Is there a problem?"
That was Rodolphus, the first time he had spoken since he set foot in the ward. Interesting man. He had nothing of the beauty or the allure of his wife. Even though Bellatrix's appearance was unorthodox, she was still magnetic. Rodolphus, on the other hand, was badly shaven and gaunt, sporting deep shadows under his eyes, and he emitted a pungent smell. Of course, although Lorna was mostly interested in the advancement of her career, she still had medical knowledge. She could see at a glance that someone had not taken the proper steps to recover from long-term dementor influence. She could see the disruption in sleep patterns and the alcoholism, plus a bit of malnutrition. But perhaps he had always been disgusting, who knew?
"Not at all, Mr. Lestrange," Lorna answered easily.
In the background, Lockhart changed posture, still resting against the wall, but now trying to showcase his ass.
"It is simply that Mr. and Mrs. Longbottom no longer receive medical care in this institution. We can't simply treat certain people here, you understand. Frankly, it is shameful that they had been tolerated so long, but I suppose their so-called pure blood status helped in preventing an earlier release. Ah, thank you, Pileski."
Bellatrix did not look happy at hearing this. Ernestina trembled and moved slightly behind Lorna, as if afraid of the power of Bellatrix's gaze. Lorna, for her part, opened the file completely unconcerned by the murderous Death Eater standing in front of her and the sobbing Meadowitch cowering behind. Her nails were freshly done, a rich, deep green that was almost black. Narcissa would approve.
I'm sure we have the current institution on file. This will only take a moment. Let's see admittance, diagnosis, and symptoms. Not much improvement through the years, I see. Our release. Oh, well, this is inconvenient.
Lorna finally rose her eyes from the folder and looked back at Bellatrix.
I'm afraid no one would take charge of them. So they were simply released on the streets. Still, they can't have wandered very far in their state. Pileski, are you there?
Yes, madam.
The Longbottoms, Pileski.
You told me to take them to the riverbank, madam?
Ernestina managed to say through the tears and the heaving breath.
Lest they found their way back inside.
She said no more, her voice lost in her sobs. Her mascara was terribly smudged.
So thoughtful of me.
Nona tapped the fire with a nail.
What a pity. Had I known of your interest sooner, I would, of course, have held them for you. I'm truly sorry that I can't be of any more assistance.
Understandable,
Bellatrix conceded.
You have to keep this place free of vermin, after all.
Ernestina sobbed harder at her words.
Precisely.
Could I still be round?
Rodolphus's voice was broken, as if his tongue weighed heavily on his mouth. He was not used to talking.
I suppose so, yes,
answered Lorna with just a shrug of her left shoulder.
If they found some shelter and remembered to drink water every other day or so.
Once they're out of my care, they're not a concern of mine, but from a medical standpoint, I would say they could survive for a week at the most. They thanked her, and Lorna made some more polite talk, and then Lockhart came closer and said he was late to a photo session, but of course he could spare 5 minutes for a fan, especially one as lovely as Bellatrix. Soon after, the Lestranges were gone.
Honestly, Pileski, how can you still be crying?
Perhaps Lorna sounded dismissive, but she was honestly curious. Had she been crying for so long, she was sure she would be dizzy by now.
Sorry, madam.
Take 5 minutes to compose yourself and drink some water. You must be dehydrated.
Yes, madam. Not a calming potion, though. They are highly addictive. You must learn to control yourself.
Yes, madam.
You did well, though. I don't expect we will see them again.
You think so, madam?
We will see. They may want you to show them where exactly you did leave the Longbottoms, and after today's crying spectacle, they will be expecting some little secret. If they ask, wait 4 questions, and then tell them that you knew they would die if left alone by the river, and that you felt sorry for them. So you left them on the Muggle Street to the leaky cauldron, hoping they would find their way inside, or maybe someone would take them in. Understood?
Ernestina sniffled.
Yes, madam.
Good. Go, now.
It has been said before, Slytherin-Hufflepuff relations are terribly dangerous. A Hufflepuff will be willing to risk their life hiding patients in their home for as long as necessary, forever if that's what it takes. A Slytherin will be the one to foresee that they have to do it, and will devise the plan to make it possible and lie to the face of an unhinged sadist. Not to say that Gryffindor-Ravenclaw relationships are a thing to be dismissed. The last thing a fearless person needs is someone feeding them knowledge and requesting their help with research. This is the basis of dragon studies. Percy was more and more convinced that wizards had got it all wrong. The fact that they were engaged in a war would support this theory, but it didn't have anything to do with that, or not much. What he meant is that they saw Muggles as weaker and beneath them, either to kill and enslave them or to protect them, but in any case weaker and stupider than them. Percy was not his dad. He did not share his fascination with Muggle ingenuity, but he did pay attention to his father, more than any of his brothers, actually. Not that it was ever appreciated. Percy was never appreciated. Not a complaint, just a statement. At the moment, that lack of appreciation was what allowed him to work unnoticed. Hooray for ignored middle children. Side note, he should check with Ron, because Ronald was also very much a middle child like him, and it occurred to Percy now that his little brother might be sitting on some big secrets of his own. Percy digressed. He was doing that more and more lately, his mind split with the present and the thousand futures that opened before him, what would be, what could be, what was going to be, but was not anymore because Percy intervened, the new future that came to take that place. But also the million present ideas he had to hold in his mind, all the names and places and connections and plans. His mind was full of side notes and threads. He was so tired. But what he meant, Muggles, yes. Not as big a fan as his dad, but he listened enough that Percy could move through Muggle London unnoticed, something that his father sadly wasn't able to do. Percy could sign himself up for yoga classes, because here came the point, Muggles had things that wizards did not, and those things were better. Wizards had got it all wrong, Muggles were the ones above them. Case in point, the family-sized bag of Walkers Percy had just eaten all by himself. He was full of crisps and salt and regret, and his lips and tongue hurt. He also felt so good, so good. Percy upended the bag in his hand, letting the small crumbs fall on his palm and licking them from there. No shame. Percy was single-handedly toppling down a madman. No one was allowed to judge. Percy went outside and bought himself eight different bags of crisps. There was red and green and blue and dark pink and dark blue, or possibly purple and brown, and a lighter brown and some kind of dark red to represent bacon. He didn't eat them all at once. He rationed them for the days when he did something particularly good and he deserved an award, saved the Edgecombes like a boss, and for the days when he failed and he needed a reminder that there was more to life and that he was not to blame, not too much, if he couldn't save everyone. Draco was occupied with sucking Harry's bottom lip and finding that this was a nice thing and that he liked it, just as he liked moving his hands across Harry's chest and feeling in turn how Harry grabbed his shoulders. It was all very nice and good, and it unclenched the permanent knot of tension in his belly to be substituted by a tingling sensation and a different kind of tension altogether. It was nice and slow and lazy, kissing each other unhurriedly. So Draco failed to see why Harry suddenly had to sit back, lips swollen and wet from kissing. He looked at him with green eyes, green like sour green lemons, green like a beautiful, peaceful place Draco had never visited. Harry's eyes were always bright, and in Draco's mind, they had become the sun. Not that he was ever going to tell him this, probably, almost certainly not. Harry looked at him, blinking quickly to focus his sight. That was another thing. Draco had put on Harry's glasses and felt instantly dizzy. The boy was practically blind. How was he a seeker? But Harry looked at him with eyes the color of sin and lips glistening with Draco's spit, and his hair mussed from when Draco had buried his hands in it and said, "Your father had a Horcrux," which did terrible, terrible things to Draco's belly and the pleasing tingle that was growing there. "Please don't bring up my father now. About kissing now. Shh." He kissed Harry twice more, but, yeah, the mood was gone. Draco let himself fall back on the bed, an arm hanging loose and the other thrown over his face. It was not all dramatic, Sirius was right. Their theatrical reputation was completely unfounded. He sighed. "Why?" he said. He knew, he just knew he wouldn't be able to let go of the thought now. You can't just go around and mention certain things to people with his level of anxiety. It was hard enough to stop the intruding nasty thoughts. He didn't need to go get new ones. "It's just, I was thinking..."
"Why were you thinking about anything other than me?"
"Yes, why would I do that, Malfoy?" It was so unfair that Harry had somehow learned to deadpan in the best Snape tradition. Draco didn't have to move his arm from his face to know Harry was smiling, though.
"But not really, listen. Your father had a Horcrux. Maybe someone else has one. We're pretty sure he's following a theme of the objects, but I don't think he's doing the same with the locations."
He was right. Draco could tell already. There was the ancestral house and that weird cave with the locket.
"Do you mean he was maybe trying to follow a theme, but he couldn't pull it off?"
"I don't know, it's just maybe he left one with someone while he thought of a good place." So Draco had his make-out session rudely interrupted, but at least the idea had some value, and when they spoke to Hermione the next day, she agreed. They said that Dullahov had been planning something with some dark wizards of the Nordic countries, and that after his death, Rosier had fled there. Given that Rosier and Mulciber were still to be found, it was understandable that now Voldemort wanted to keep informed on everyone's activities and whereabouts. This meant that despite the regular updates in the Caro's name, Severus now had to leave Hogwarts every 2 or 3 weeks to report in person. It wasn't too bad. There was, of course, the lying to his darkness's face and managing his vigilibancy, but Severus found little trouble with that. He was a skilled storyteller, so he knew exactly what to say. Was everything fine in Hogwarts? No, of course not. See, that was key. He couldn't just say yes, that was unbelievable. Instead, he complained about the Caros and how their sadism wasn't helping much in the indoctrination of the students. Sure, the whole castle was terrified and giving him less trouble than expected, but scarred and mutilated people would do for a poor addition to Voldemort's army.
"An iron hand in a velvet glove, my dear Severus,"
is all Voldemort told him. Some asked after their kids. Not Lucius, of course, not him. He had to be very careful not to mention his son or paternity in any way. But not Goyle, Crabbe, and even Parkinson and a few others occasionally asked. Severus merely glanced at them and said those who were loyal had nothing to fear. There was a threat in Severus's work, a reminder to all Death Eaters that their children were at the mercy of the most devoted and beloved servant of Voldemort. The Dark Lord smiled when he heard him. It was ridiculous how easy it was for Severus to please him. So the trips weren't too bad. Nerve-wracking, perhaps, because one bad thought could set off alarms in Voldemort's mind, and he would discover everything. But all in all, not too bad. Certainly Severus wasn't the one who had to defend himself. It was what happened around the trips to Voldemort that was strange and unsettling. Once Severus was by the gates of Hogwarts, he never apparated directly to the manor. It was a habit from past days, that he always took an indirect route, or at the very least, he apparated a bit away from his destination, enough that he could walk for 10 or 15 minutes before reaching the place. He found that time helped him settle his mind and arrange his thoughts. He also found an inordinately high number of squibs, muggleborns, and crooks, muggles who married magic, and on one particularly bizarre occasion the centaur Firenze. When the meeting was in the Ministry, or nearby, Severus could understand. People who had inexplicably managed to escape arrest and the holding cells and then came across Severus, fine, but he was not ashamed to admit that he was veritably perplexed when he found the aforementioned Firenze, with a squib girl called Gadea sitting on his rump standing there on the path to Malfoy Manor. And they were not of much help about how it came to be. For the most part, people said that they saw their opportunity and went for it. Just plain good luck that there was a wand lying there, or they overheard that the special operator had a very upset stomach so they could overpower him with mere physical strength, or would you believe it, the pursuers got stuck in a cupboard and they simply ran. Yes, everybody ran. They ran right into Severus. It was weird, and he knew he should look into it. At first he had been sure that it was some sort of trap, except that it didn't make much sense. If Severus were truly a Death Eater, there was the risk that he would murder them instantly, so it would be a pretty stupid plan to test his loyalty. Besides, he knew Firenze and a few of the others. Some had been his students, children who graduated years ago, and now were scared adults, fighting for their lives. It was weird, but Severus knew better than to question it at the moment. He simply extended his hand and took them to Hogwarts when there were plenty of beds and a well-stocked kitchen and medical attention. For the most part, they went with him unquestioningly, and given that Severus was a prominent Death Eater, it made you wonder what kind of miracles they had witnessed, that they would simply take his hand without fear. There are categories to wickedness. There is evil and there is pettiness. Though, of course, the first causes more damage and more death, but in their defense they are often acting for an ideal, twisted and vicious as it may be. They are not evil for themselves, but for a cause. There is some perverted notion of nobility in there. Then there is the petty and the malevolent. Their acts are smaller and thus judged safer and kinder because they do not kill or harm like evil does. But that is just due to their own limitations. The petty are cowardly and selfish. What they do, whatever bad they cause, they do not do it for an ideal but for themselves, for their wretched little black souls. Today an evil person and a petty one had come together. When evil rises, the small, the petty, the cruel and rancorous come to ride by the tail of their coats. Bellatrix Lestrange thought that Professor Swindell's was too similar to Pettigrew to be even slightly tolerable. There was certainly no need to have two of them.
Swindell's was also terribly ineffective, whereas Pettigrew managed to return his wands to the Dark Lord. She would give him that. Swindell's, for his part, couldn't find his own ass sitting in a chair, but he was pure-blooded enough, and he was an avid supporter of the cause, so they kept him around. They had put him in the Wizengamot to review the appeal cases where his inefficiency could be best used. He was a low-level employee of the Ministry, and Bella was Bellatrix Lestrange, and that still meant something, even if lately the Lord was sparing in his affection. Normally they wouldn't have crossed paths, but Bella had been tasked, or rather had requested the task after Rosier's and Mulciber's absconding, to find her dear cousin Sirius, and the werewolf who accompanied him, and murder both of them. It was proving a bit more difficult than expected, since no one had seen them in over a year. She was now looking for whatever information the previous Ministry had gathered on them, hopefully a current list of known associates, since Bella was quite sure that all of their old friends were dead. It took Swindell's 25 minutes to find the correct reference for the file. Bellatrix gave him an open sore curse in the legs just for making her wait. But at last he had found it, and in his sugary obsequiousness he insisted on accompanying her to retrieve the papers from the archives. He was the radical opposite of the neat, cold witch that assisted Bellatrix at St. Mungo's. She didn't make her wait, and she was properly dressed, unlike this little man, who had holes in his socks and kept talking and talking in an attempt to ingratiate himself to Bella. But of course he talked so much he was eventually bound to mention something important. Swindell's kept the professor title because he had been one, at Hogwarts no less. Nice place, but he had nothing good to say of the faculty, particularly Dumbledore or Severus Snape.
"Horrible man that Snape is," muttered Swindell's,
not realizing he was criticizing one of Voldemort's favorites. It was no secret that Bellatrix disliked Snape, but it was no secret because only she could afford to show her true feelings about the man. Everyone else had too much to lose. It wasn't just that Snape would poison you for the insult, it was that Voldemort cherished him, and he would order your death. But Swindells was too stupid to appreciate this, and so he added,
"Now respect for traditions and the meaning of true British magic."
"Is he now?" said Bellatrix, with something like a white shock of electricity hiding behind her pupils.
"Oh, madam, I won't repeat the things he said out of respect for you. They are not for feminine ears. But I can assure you he was most vehement, defending this insolent student of mine, a brown one, you know. Did this man not know the Mulciber family, the Shacklebolts, the Supathers?
True, they had not all come to the call of the Dark Lord, and the ones who did, the Mulcibers, had disgraced themselves even more than the Shacklebolts ever had with their open resistance. But their blood was pure, certainly purer than Swindell's, who reeked of half-blood. And they were competent, something he could not claim for himself." But regardless of his idiocy, what he said next was interesting.
"Do tell more,"
asked Bellatrix, with lips red and full like a flower in bloom.
"I really don't think it is appropriate for a lady to
tell me."
Her voice did not inspire the same command as Severus's. It did not have that velvety quality. But she had a very nice mouth, Bellatrix. Her lips were a dream. She also had teeth. White and sharp and very much like a predator. Sometimes it felt as if she were speaking just with her teeth. Despite her animagus form, Minerva didn't particularly like cats. This is, of course, quite fitting with cat nature. Real cats don't like other cats either, they merely tolerate their existence. The fact that Dolores Umbridge surrounded herself with cat imagery was a particularly personal insult to Minerva. She had once transformed into her cat form for the sole purpose of finding Umbridge and scratching her when she attempted to pet her. Okay, maybe more than once. Minerva didn't like cats. Not even the one she had, which was not hers. She was just minding the little beast until his rightful owner returns to Hogwarts to reclaim him. As far as cats went, though, Crookshanks wasn't completely terrible. He respected Minerva and only came to her when he needed food or cuddles. Crookshanks was a properly independent young cat. Well, not so young, but independent and strong-minded, and Minerva approved. Crookshanks was also a cat with a vendetta. We don't pay much attention to the private life of animals, but they have just as much drama as humans. How could we not mention the tragedy of poor Crookshanks losing his mistress, or the sorrow experienced by Mrs. Norris when the only student in the school she allowed to pet her disappeared without so much as a goodbye? She had sought comfort in the strange blonde girl, and she was gentle, but it was not the same. She did not have sardines with her, and she once offered Mrs. Norris a radish, a radish. These were their stories and their problems. In the case of these two cats in particular, or three, depending on Minerva's mood, they had lost loved ones, and they had made a few enemies, and on a cold day with a white sky, one of those enemies returned to Hogwarts. Sometimes it looks like the Sorting Hat made a mistake. Sometimes you see a person and the traits of his house and wonder, how could that be? How could Percy, the Weasley who abandoned his family, be a Gryffindor at all? How could that weird Luna who believed in all sorts of silly things be a Ravenclaw? How could Neville, for Merlin's sake, who came to Hogwarts shaking and unable to stand for himself, be in Gryffindor? How could Ernie McMillan, the one who sold Hermione, be in the house known for its loyalty? They could. The Sorting Hat doesn't make mistakes. Sometimes you don't know everything about a person, and sometimes the traits of the house don't mean what you thought. Ernie McMillan wasn't a traitor. No matter what Ron or anyone else said, he was loyal to his family, and thus he did what was necessary to protect them. Here is another example. Peter Pettigrew, the man who gave up his friends to the Dark Lord, the man who begged for his life to Sirius and Remus, who cried and tried to invoke Hermione's compassion or Ron's affection, that man was a Gryffindor. People had often wondered at Peter's sorting into Gryffindor ever since his school years, always following his more flashing and talented friends, always hiding behind them and praising their actions. The Sorting Hat doesn't make mistakes. Peter was no coward. Peter had the courage to realize his shortcomings and accept a lower position, humiliating himself in order to get an advantage. Peter had the courage to fight for his life above everything else. Peter Pettigrew had the courage to sell his soul to save his life. You have to be very brave to damn yourself to hell. It should be said that Peter didn't enjoy his betrayal. And it was a betrayal, for he had not been seduced, like many others, by the promises of gold and silk that the Dark Lord made. He did not hate James and Lily, and he was very sorry for them. James had always been good to him, got him sketchbooks and colored pencils, and always praised his drawings. Lily was a bit too intense, and Peter was scared of her. He thought she had always suspected him the way she looked at him, but she was good to him, too. They were both good. They were his friends, and Peter did not want either of them to die, nor Harry. But as it turns out, Peter had the courage to live with himself after their deaths. Again and again, he always had the courage to choose himself. However, every time he did, it seemed like the choice became harder. He chose himself and gave up his friends to the Dark Lord, and he paid with his soul, damned forever. He chose himself, and he had to cut his own finger as he let his friend Sirius be arrested in his place. He chose himself and lost a hand, bringing back Voldemort, the one who could protect him from Sirius's and Remus's anger. Every time, the price increased. Every time, the choice was harder.
"I don't trust Snape," said Bella,
a dark curl falling down her forehead and over her left eye.
"He is hiding something. Go to Hogwarts and find out what it is."
She pouted, like a little girl who had just been awoken from a nap, an unholy mixture of innocence and sex.
"Report only to me."
Peter did not want to go. Peter thought that even if Hogwarts was under the power of Snape and the Carrows, it was still populated by a high number of people who would see him dead.
"Come now, Pettigrew, or I will crucio you so hard that you will wish you were Frank Longbottom."
Bellatrix made it easy. There wasn't much room to choose. You simply did whatever she wanted. It was the certainty of facing her versus the possibility of being found in Hogwarts. So, of course, Peter would choose the latter, and in doing that, he would choose himself. Besides, whatever she suspected of Snape, it wouldn't be so bad that if Peter found himself in danger, he couldn't reveal himself and ask for his protection. Snape was no traitor. He was like Peter, too damned and too stained to look back. Maybe he was in talks with some foreign wizards, and maybe he was working to have Bella fall. Everybody knew they couldn't stand to each other, just as everybody knew that Snape was Lucius Malfoy's little bitch. But in any case, Snape wouldn't let Peter be killed. So Peter returns to Hogwarts. He apparated to the station in Hogsmeade and walked under the dark to the castle's gates. He could not cross the wards that defended Hogwarts. Only Snape could allow someone to pass through. but Peter was not stupid. Another prejudice people often held over him. He was not as charming as his friends, but he was clever. He transformed into his rat form and waited belly up for an owl to come pick him up. He waited for hours, cold and a bit damp. But at some point before sunrise, an owl swooped down and caught him in its claws. As soon as he was across the wards, Peter transformed back into a human, dragging the owl to the ground with him. He killed the bird and felt a petty pleasure doing it. He walked all the way to the castle's front door just for the sake of walking through the grounds in his human form. He had spent years around the castle as a rat, the castle for which he drew the map that later Sirius animated. No one knew the castle as well as he did. No one. Not the other Marauders, nor the Weasley twins, nor Harry Potter himself. Peter transformed into Scabbers and squeezed through an air vent to the kitchen. Percy woke up in the middle of the night, which was always upsetting because he really needed his sleep. A careful examination of his alarm clock, however, revealed that it was not so much the middle of the night as insultingly early morning. He would have to get up in little over an hour, so there was probably no point in trying to go back to sleep now. He went to the bathroom, dragging his feet and with his eyes closed. Closed eyes meant protecting himself from the glare of the bathroom light and also from his reflection in the bathroom mirror. It had always been difficult to face himself in the mornings because Percy had unruly curly hair, the kind that does not make for a pretty picture early in the morning. No one else in his large family had hair like this, wild and prone to knots and tangles. It always took him a long time to get ready in the mornings, but he would rather be teased for being prim and vain than for the gnome house his hair became during the night. There was no one to tease him now, but there were other reasons to avoid the mirror. Since he was up early, he could go ahead and make a big breakfast with eggs and bacon. It was not like the ones his mother made him. What did she do to sausages that Percy wasn't able to recreate? But it was better than the mug of tea and two slices of toast he usually had. It was not until breakfast had been consumed and he had already combed his hair twice, although with eyes closed, so he had only gotten rid of the knots and there was the actual styling to do, that Percy felt like he could face the mirror. He took a deep breath. "What?" he said. At first his reaction was nothing more than that, but then the mirror Percy frowned and stepped aside, and Percy was left standing there in his bathroom staring at the futures that could be. This was the thing. Percy could see the future, but he could not see all the futures. He had been surprised a few times because often the threads were hidden behind each other, and Percy had to decide which one was important. But for the most part, today it looked like everything would fix itself. There was that, yes, not a problem, and that other thing, oh, look at that. And the Diggorys were going to have a fight in the evening because Cedric was way too vocal about his dislike of the new regime. Amos would like his son to show more restraint, but Cedric was a stubborn one. Cedric would say that since his father was so worried about public opinion, he would not burden him any more with his presence, and he would just get up and leave the house. Tragic, but it did not require Percy's intervention. Didn't it? There was more to that threat. Oh, yes. Some Death Eaters were coming after Cedric now that he had publicly disengaged from his family. That was the rule. If you abandoned a pure-blood family, you were a blood traitor and had to be punished. Of course, if you didn't and you kept that kind of attitude, then the whole family was classified as traitorous and purged. The exception being Percy, of course, he was the good one, and through him his siblings were protected. In any case, Cedric would be fine. He was still Triwizard Champion material. Percy sighed a little bit at the beautiful image Cedric would make, jumping on his broom with the sun giving him a golden halo as he waved goodbye to the stunned Death Eaters. He would flee to Europe, and it seemed that Victor Crumb would give him sanctuary, thus proving that the whole spiel about strengthening international relations with the Triwizard Tournament had been more than propaganda. None of this merited Percy waking up, so what was... Oh, there. There was his father getting dressed in silence and sneaking out of the house. He would be in trouble in about 10 minutes. Surely a balding man would have more sense than to face 4 Death Eaters by himself. He was supposed to be hiding. How did he even find those Death Eaters to fight? Percy barely had time to throw on a hoodie, another wonderful Muggle invention, before apparating away. The mirror went back to being a mirror. If Severus had to choose one thing, one single thing of his relationship with Remus, It would be the fact that he was allowed to touch and kiss without any other expectations, kissing just for its own sake, kissing to let him know that he was somewhere in his thoughts at all times. Severus liked casual kissing. He liked it a lot. Not to say that he was kissing Remus all the time, because he was still headmaster of Hogwarts. He couldn't very well be seen snogging his boyfriend in a corner. But the rest of the time, when they walked by the forest line, and when they took the stairs to the bedroom, or when they were brushing their teeth, Severus could touch and drop gentle kisses, and it made him more happy than he ever thought he had a right to be. Like now, he could give Remus a passing kiss now, not even looking if it landed on a cheek or a shoulder or somewhere in between, just the instinctual reaction to his closeness. You are near me, I shall kiss you. He kissed Remus even when he had other things on his mind. I really don't see why Slytherins are associated with violence instead of Gryffindors, Severus said as he stepped back, carding his fingers through his hair. It had grown longer than usual, and he was too busy to think of cutting it, even though it was also becoming bothersome. He had acquired a hair tie, and he could now make a loose top knot to keep the hair away from his face. Lovegood had given him a sunflower hair clip. He was saving it for a special occasion, one in which he could make at least two Weasleys choke on their drinks. Remus made a laughing sound, bending over the sink so he wouldn't spray the mirror with toothpaste. He spit, rinsed his mouth, and turned around, still smiling. You have a corpse-dropping place, Severus. An actual place where you would get rid of a body. Which remains unused. Truly such a pity that neither Quirrell nor Lockhart nor Umbridge came to occupy it. Remus smiled again. He smiled a lot throughout the day. The pleasant smiles of the werewolf who tried to make himself non-threatening, meek smiles like weak tea that Severus disliked. And there was also the actual wolf smile that Severus had no idea he made, the smile that put a warm tingle in everyone's bellies. And there was the smile of the proud teacher when a student got something right. Those smiles had chocolate and nuts in them. Then there was the caramel smile when a student failed, and nevertheless Remus was able to show them why he failed and understand and learn. He was such a good teacher, they were really fortunate to have him now. Remus smiled differently with Sirius and the twins. Those smiles were naughty, wicked, something lively and citric in them. Severus had his very own smile just for him. He treasured that smile. But as much as he liked observing and cataloguing each and every one of Remus's smiles, what Severus truly valued was that he also got the moments of sadness and doubt and regret. He did not like those moments because he did not like Remus suffering, not at all. If it were up to him, Remus would always be warm and cozy and never know another day of pain in his life. But Severus valued them nonetheless because he was the only one who got them, the only one trusted enough to see him vulnerable. And this was not one of those moments, however. There was mirth in the air. Right. Remus nodded as he put his toothbrush in the cup next to Severus's. Unused murder place, not violent at all. Just for that, he kissed him again, and he felt Remus smile under his lips. Today was going to be a good day. The school was noisy and crowded, and similar to how it had been for the 7 years Peter had been there as a rat. You would think that having Snape and the Carrows there would make the children less rowdy. You would think Flitwick wouldn't walk around so chirpily. He was supposed to be in iron shackles, given his half-breed nature. There should be no humming. You would think there would be more Slytherin decor. You would think. That was Sirius Black. That was Sirius Black. Sirius Black was in Hogwarts. Sirius Black was standing there, holding 3 different conversations at once. If Sirius was there, surely it meant Remus was there too, and perhaps even Harry Potter. Merlin and Morgana flying on a broomstick. Peter had to know more. He had to search and find out. Over the next few hours, Peter explored the whole castle top to bottom. It was an exhausting activity for someone who was barely larger than a hand, and Peter had to be extra careful to keep out of sight of the adults. But he saw so much. Sadly, Harry wasn't there, which would have made the Lord immensely happy, but he had found irrefutable proof that Snape was a traitor. Who would have known? Certainly Peter would never have guessed, and he had pulled one hell of a betrayal. What was even better was that it wasn't just Snape who would be punished. This was not like Dolohov being killed for his failures. Snape had filled the castle with refugees, and in bringing him down, they would also be taking plenty of other enemies, Sirius Remus, that bitch McGonagall, a few Weasleys, an improbable number of Muggleborns, even a centaur. He would request to kill the Weasleys himself. It would also be great to kill Remus and Sirius, but he knew he would never get them. Bellatrix hated Sirius too much. Maybe Remus, though, although he had heard that the other werewolves, the loyal, proper werewolves, were thinking of eating him alive, so perhaps Peter wouldn't get him either. But the Weasleys, yes, he could get the Weasleys. He didn't know with whom he would begin, though. That stupid Ronald who jinxed him, or the horrible twins, or maybe the girl. Yes. The little sister, so the others could hear her scream. Ronald would be last, and Peter would teach him how it feels to beg for your life and not get any help. He would make him beg and cry and scream, and in the end he would kill each and every one of them. Although in Ron's case, he would make him wait, make him live for days knowing that his siblings were dead. There was a scream right then, something like a kettle letting steam, if that kettle were made of murder. It was followed by a flash of orange. Peter had been careful to keep out of sight of the humans, but he had completely forgotten about the cats. The bloody cat was chasing him, but Peter was clever, so much cleverer than a stupid, filthy cat, cleverer than all his friends and anyone, really. Peter was the one who survived again and again. He was clever, and he knew Hogwarts better than the founders themselves. He ran down the balustrade with the cat hot on his tail, climbed up a vertical wall into an archway, jumped to a different level that would require taking three different flights of stairs to reach. The cat was fast and nimble, but so are rats, and they can fit in places where a cat can't. They went down a corridor at full speed, running under the robes and feet of the students walking there. Peter heard their surprised voices as if they came from far away. He thought a few of them tried to stop the cat in case Peter were someone's pet. Wouldn't that be fun? Let them stop the cat and let them help Peter get away. He would be back soon enough to show his gratitude. Peter laughed, exhilarated, when he found the little drain in the east corridor of the second floor, the one with the grill missing a corner, and barely big enough for a rat to squeeze through, but he did, he did. He went through and put a little bit of distance before turning around to laugh at the cat who had squeezed his paw inside and was feeling around. Peter laughed again as the cat removed his leg and pressed his ugly flat nose to the small opening. How he pawed and scratched and meowed at the drain, but he could do nothing, nothing. Once more, Peter prevailed. Once more, he escaped his enemies. Oh, and so many of them. Bellatrix had sent to report only to her, but not only had he found that Snape was a traitor, but he had seen Sirius and Remus, too. Sirius and Remus, who beat him and insulted him and tried to kill him that night almost 4 years ago. No, he would tell the Dark Lord directly, and he would be rid of all of them. They had tried to kill him. Peter didn't feel sorry for them. He didn't feel sorry for anyone. At last, they would all see who deserved to be on top, who had the courage to climb to that position. Peter should have kept looking forward. It would have been better. But he couldn't help it. He just couldn't. He kept looking over his shoulder, although he knew very well that no cat would be able to chase him down there. No one could get inside the pipe system. He kept looking and thinking how wonderful it was that he was putting so much distance between them. So far already. He was getting away once more. And again, such wonderful news for Voldemort. Voldemort would give him everything he desired. And Bella. Oh, perhaps she would take him to bed, or he would take her. So grateful she would have to be for having ridden her of Snape. Maybe he would let her play for a while with the little Weasley girl before he killed her in front of her brothers. What beautiful dreams was Peter weaving. He was in rat form, which is a form quite suited for fables. This one would be a story about keeping your mind in the present and not thinking ahead of you when there still remain obstacles to overcome. Peter didn't look forward, and so he didn't meet the eyes. Those terrible, terrible eyes that killed you the moment they locked with yours. They were terrible, but they were also a kindness. Peter didn't see them, and so he ran directly into the teeth. And by then it was too late. The basilisk ate Peter. Teeth crushing bone and poisonous spit burning the skin. It spit out the little silver paw, and didn't think much about it, other than how nice it was for rats to jump directly into your mouth. It would be a long time before anyone discovered the fate of Peter Pettigrew. It would require Crookshanks pointing insistently to McGonagall, and she figuring out that there was something in the sewers, and a third-year Ravenclaw loaning them her pet ferret. Ferrets weren't allowed in the school. How did she get one? A ferret that could move through the pipes and bring back a small silver paw. Rom would cast two Protegos on himself before confessing that maybe there was a basilisk going through the pipes of Hogwarts that Harry had refused to kill. A long, long time before all that happened. Meanwhile, Bellatrix waited for Peter and noticed his absence. She did not care about Pettigrew going missing, but she cared about the delay in her plans. Wars have a lot of downtime. Wars, in fact, are won during the downtime. The side that doesn't lose its mind waiting, the side that refrains from doing something stupid during the lulls of time, that is the winning side. Both the brilliant and the terrible ideas come at these intervals between the fighting. It was at a time like this that Bellatrix thought of looking for the Longbottoms. It was at a time like this that she started to plan how to manipulate things so she could get to Hogwarts and see with her own eyes whatever Snape was getting up to. It was at times like these when she lay in bed and imagined the voice of her lord, how angry he would be, but also how pleased with her. She lay in bed half naked and caressed the skin of her forearm, careful not to touch the mark. Not yet. But once she was there, once she had seen and had the proof, oh, then she would touch, and she would call her lord to reveal the traitor, and it would be so good. Bellatrix was insane. There was no denying it. One could easily think that it had been the long decade in Azkaban that made it that way, but if anything, the emotional suppression of the Dementors was almost therapeutic. She had been insane before that. You have to be to follow someone with that zeal. But she was more than just an insane witch. She was the best duelist out of all of the Death Eaters. The best. She was also very intelligent, like all blacks were. It was just the poor control of her emotions that prevented her from making a better use of her mind. She did not have patience for long-term plans, and she often got too agitated to manipulate people properly. She couldn't help letting her rage overcome her, and she ended up screaming. Ironically, Bella envied her sister's coolness. The detachment with which Narcissa was able to move, as if absolutely nothing in this world could affect her. Sometimes she told Narcissa gruesome things about the war, or talked about the son that had been repudiated just to see if she could make her snap. She knew it was cruel, but wasn't Narcissa cruel too? Flaunting that temperance, that impeccable control, making herself the queen of ice and snow when Bellatrix couldn't do that. Bellatrix fucked her husbands to get her mind off of things, and when that wasn't enough, because Rodolphus was little more than a shell, she went and found herself someone else. Someone pretty and full of energy that afterwards would leave her sated and relaxed and ready to think. The stupid rat had failed, and she wasn't surprised. Most likely he had fled, scared of what he had seen and scared of Voldemort himself. That only proved what Bellatrix suspected. It was her fault, really. She should have gone herself. She would. The problem was that Bellatrix had made it about herself and about Snape. And even though she was right, her lord wouldn't hear another word about it. Men were obdurate. But she was not so clumsy that she could not turn it around, and so she waited for the next meeting when Snape gave his report as usual, calm, precise, somehow giving the impression of effectiveness and of not dawdling around wasting precious time that could best be employed in the Lord's cause. She waited, digging her nails into her thigh so she could keep a neutral face, and when he was done, she spoke. What wonderful work was Severus doing in Hogwarts? Perhaps sometime in the future, once he had time to prepare, of course. She didn't want to impose. They could drop by. Bella would so love to see how her dear goddaughter Millicent was doing, and maybe little Pansy had grown out of that phase, whatever it was that came over her. Gaius Bulstrode opened his mouth to point out that Bella was no one's godmother, and certainly not the little hog beast of his, as if she would ever consent to having such a disappointing child near her, but he wisely shut himself instantly. Once he had time to prepare, she had said. And once she uttered those words, there was no way that Snape wouldn't rise to the challenge, and say he required no preparation and they could visit at once. That's the problem with perfection. You can't suddenly delay and give excuses. Plus, Bella wasn't completely removed from the world. She knew half of them wanted to know about their children. She understood that parents were concerned about their children.
"If our lord believes it adequate," Snape said slowly.
It didn't pay to speak quickly. It made you look too eager to convince, too worried about someone noticing your faults. She hated the man, but she recognized he was good.
I will be glad for the opportunity to show the improvement of their children.
Improvement was an excellent word. It sounded positive, but it also implied that there had been room to improve in the first place, that someone had been less than perfect. And he had said there, not the children, but there. And there had been quite a lot of shifting, because suddenly no one wanted to be the father whose child had to improve. Voldemort spoke then, a spark of pleasure in his red eyes. So nice to finally see Bella. He was calling her Bella, not Lestrange, not Bellatrix, Bella. And Severus being amicable. Bella smiled with that mouth of hers that looked like a poem and like a sinful dream. She felt a bit guilty, though. A bit sad that her lord could be manipulated so. This was the Dark Lord, this was Lord Voldemort, the conqueror of death, protector of the pure blood. He should not be led so. But he had called her Bella, at least. That was all she wanted to hear. Severus, on the other hand, was less pleased with Voldemort's words. Severus had a castle full of people that shouldn't be there, and the children were remarkably unindoctrinated. The last thing he needed was to have a parent visit day, but that was a problem 20 minutes into the future. Severus had another more current problem to navigate, like pleasing Voldemort and leaving the meeting alive. Dolohov's death was very present in everyone's minds, as was Rosier's and Mulciper's disappearance and lately Pettigrew's. He knew, if he fought this even a little bit, he would have lost, because then they would accompany him for sure, no matter what. But it wasn't just that. Voldemort was a legilimens for Merlin and Morgana's sake. For all that Bellatrix was pulling strings down to get to Hogwarts, all she needed to do was make Voldemort want to get a good look at Severus's mind, and without Remedy, any of his multiple secrets would come tumbling down. Voldemort wasn't looking at him. His hand was resting idly over his wand, his index finger barely touching the wood. Severus glanced at Lucius and let himself admire the figure he cut, the perfect elegance of the lines of his body. He had always been handsome, and he had aged well, although he was giving a less than perfect image ever since Draco. Not only had Draco left, taking with him half of Lucius's symbolic power, but he had returned to save a mudblood, no less. That had been a horrible political hit. Lucius was making a good job of keeping him passive during this school talk, his eyes following the silent and graceful movements of his wife around the room, the wife that more and more resembled a spirit or a ghost. And Severus couldn't believe there had been a time when he envied her. But Lucius, for all his elegance, was an earthly creature, cold, yes, and unattainable, but also sinful, and oh, what sins he could bring to mind, what lovely sins. Severus let himself think of some of them and of whatever they had shared, the times when Severus would have done anything for him. And then he brought to mind those more recent feelings of thinking Lucius was a hopeless idiot that was ruining Draco. All true, all true. And Voldemort, yes, he had touched the wand. Severus saw it through the corner of his eye. Voldemort didn't need to say the words or even move the wand to get a glimpse of surface thoughts. Voldemort would think that Severus was angry at Lucius for allowing Draco to become the traitor he was known to be, but also Severus would seem regretful. It wasn't difficult to manipulate thoughts like this, and it would explain his current hesitance, not wanting to so publicly put Lucius on the spot for the sake of whatever they had shared. All this took less than 10 seconds, but Severus knew and understood Voldemort well enough that conjuring suitable images and feelings had become something automatic in his presence. Others might forget Voldemort was a legilimens. Even Dumbledore had done so on occasion, but never Severus. The one time he forgot, he was forced to reveal the secret that took his best friend's life.
"Yes, I don't see why not,"
said Voldemort at last. He had a soft voice, like ashes and dry leaves sliding over a stone floor. With this, Severus once more saved his life, and all the lives that depended on the secrets of his mind. Once more he deceived him, and left the room still as the loyal and beloved servant. But that was the problem of the now. The problem of 20 minutes in the future was approaching. They would come with him. There was no way he could fight Bella and the parents at the same time about the issue, not with Voldemort there looking all pleased that at last he and Bellatrix weren't fighting openly. not when this was another opportunity for Voldemort to subtly punish Lucius. Lucius had still been paying for losing Voldemort's diary when Draco went and abandoned them. His debt was now astronomical. One look from Bellatrix and Bulstrode knew to step back and simply mutter to please send his love to Millicent, who Severus knew had become good friends with Lovegood, and stopped wearing the standard black robes in favor of one she had designed and dyed herself. Yesterday morning, Lovegood had proudly showed Severus the shirt Millicent had given her and asked for his opinion. Bulstrode was out, but Crabbe and Goyle and Parkinson were coming. Goyle perhaps could be fooled because Goyle was limited. But Crabbe was more cruel and lazy than stupid, and Parkinson was a perfectly average man in talent and intelligence. And then, of course, Bella, heading the group and barely able to contain her satisfied smirk. They apparated to Hogsmeade rather than at the gates. Apparition required holding a precise image in the mind, and it was easier to think of the village than of the gates nobody paid attention to. It was not a short distance, close to an hour walk, and yet it felt minimal as they walked through the old path. Severus's intestines were liquefying and then welding themselves to the iron rod that was his spine. He could see the iron gates to Hogwarts, the gates he now had to open for them. He was the only one who could do it, and he was bringing these monsters with him. 4 Death Eaters, one of them the best duelist of the decade. What could Severus do? And whatever he did now, what would he do later? In an hour, or come morning, when their absence became conspicuous, and as good as a declaration of betrayal, what then? And that was assuming he had been madly lucky, and he had somehow managed to disarm the 4 of them. They were at the gates. Severus was granting them access. The castle was there. Barely 10 more minutes of walk. End of chapter 11. For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the AO3 and Tumblr pages of Endrina. First pass editing by Ohana. Music by Sean Johnson. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information found on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. There you can also find all the other stories that I've read, as well as links to my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.